The so-called magickers had not offered to harm Bridget in any way, although they were not the most attentive of warders or hosts. The food they supplied at irregular intervals was of poor quality, usually consisting of a fish stew mixed with a handful of unbleached rice and tasteless root vegetables. The water had a foul taste, so she drank sparingly of it, fearful of contracting dysentery. Several times she heard strange trumpeting calls outside the walls of her prison, the noise reminding her of a combination of bugle and roar. Although she couldn't be sure, she guessed elephants were the source of the sound. After she felt confident enough with the dialect, she asked what happened to the emergency ration kit she had carried. She received only a headshake. When she inquired about her pistol, she received no reaction whatsoever, which made her suspect that TP-9 was in the possession of the robed men. Her hands were untied so she could eat, and three times a day she was escorted to a place where she could relieve herself, little more than a hole in the stone floor. Her escort considerately turned his back when she was so occupied, but he inserted a hand into the belled sleeve of his robe, a silent warning he kept a weapon there. If the weapon was a knife, Bridget doubted the blade could penetrate her shadow suit, but she wasn't inclined to escape until she gathered more information. She learned the language quickly and overheard whispers of the imminent arrival of someone in authority named Brother Javalara. She wondered if he was the reason she had not eaten all day. She tried to be stoic about it, but finally she leaned forward as far as the leather cords permitted and called to the men at the fire.
Gentlemen, I have an excellent time sense, and I think I haven't eaten in at least 12 hours.
Her pronunciation of a few of the words might have been less than perfect, but the magicker seemed to understand her nevertheless. One of them, a young man called Brother Yasovar, walked over to where she sat trussed.
I am sorry you must be patient. These are difficult times. Many people in Panamkule go hungry. It is particularly difficult for us, the Guild of Magickers.
If you were any kind of decent sorcerers, you'd conjure up something to eat.
We're not that kind of magicians. You must wait until Brother Javalara arrives. He will see to all your needs.
May I ask you something, Yasovar?
Does it have to do with food?
No, not this time.
Please, proceed.
Why are you holding me prisoner in the first place? You scarcely seem able to look after yourselves.
We believe you can do much to aid the magicker's cause.
And what cause is that?
Brother Javalara will be here soon to explain. You can dine with him, and he'll tell you what he deems suitable.
I hope he brings something suitable to dine on, unless you consider what you've been feeding me a delicacy.
Yasovar stiffened, as if offended by the remark.
We lived in Kumudvati's court before Colonel Huyang had us banished.
And who would Kumudvati be again?
The Devinaga, the Serpent Princess. She outlawed my guild.
Her administration didn't care for your brand of magic? I know I can see some areas of improvement.
We were not always sorcerers.
But were you always magickers?
We have...
must overlook the young brother's tendency to overdo the bitter exile routine. It's been several years, and he has yet to come to terms with it.
The tone of voice was pleasant and conversational. A tall, gaunt man carrying a burlap bag strode toward her. He wore a thin leather skull cap on his hairless head, the forepart curving down toward the bridge of his nose like a widow's peak. It bore a golden starburst symbol, but without the addition of the spiral. The ends of a downsweeping mustache joined with a wispy goatee on his chin.
I am Brother Javalara. Yasova, release her.
The younger man bent over Bridget, withdrawing a slender knife from his sleeve. He began sawing at the bonds encircling her wrists.
You know, if you just untie me, you can use the thongs to tie up another woman.
I'm no good with knots. We'd be here all night.
I hope you don't mind dining on rabbit.
At this point, I'd eat almost anything. Within reason, that is.
Yasovar finished slicing through the thongs, binding her wrists and ankles. Javalara stepped forward, extending a hand. Bridget waved him away and stood, rubbing her wrists to restore the circulation. She realized she was almost as tall as Javalara.
I am sorry we had to treat a woman of your obvious intellectual capacity in such a fashion. What is your name?
She tossed her tangled red-gold mane over her shoulders, noting sourly the dire need for a shampoo.
Baptiste.
I am happy to have you among us, Baptiste.
But not happy enough to let me go so I can find my friends.
I am afraid for the time being, we must keep you with us.
Javalara handed the bag to Yasovar.
Prepare this, my brother. There is a certain and ongoing problem we need to find a solution to, and you appear to be qualified to help us. Tomorrow morning we will begin our journey to Angotrom.
What kind of problem are you talking about?
It has to do with the generation, balance, and manipulation of energy.
That doesn't tell me much.
I realize that, Baptiste. You will learn more, I assure you.
Another one of the magickers approached, carrying a cloth-covered bundle in his arms. Coming to stand beside Javalara, he whispered into his ear for a few seconds. Javalara nodded gravely.
Do you know anything about the two people who were with me when we were set upon?
Yes, although the news is not encouraging. The man was captured by the Cobra Guard, the Devinaga's royal police. The woman, as best as I can adjudge, is in the custody of the general.
The general? I take it he has nothing to do with the Devinaga?
No, indeed.
Do you know if they're alive?
I haven't heard anything one way or the other as to their final fates. I am sorry.
A cold knot of angry frustration tightened in the pit of Bridget's belly.
For magickers, you're about the most incompetent and poorly organized group of sorcerers I ever heard of.
I cannot debate you on that observation, Baptiste. But like Brother Yasovar said, we were not always sorcerers.
Then what were you?
Scientists.
He turned to the magicker standing at his side and whisked away the cloth. The man held the interphaser, balanced carefully on the flats of both hands.
As, apparently, are you.
The trading post wasn't quite what Kane expected. Built of ornately carved and decorated wood, the structure reminded him more of one of the temples he had glimpsed in his flyover of the Angkor Plain. Upon a second, closer look, he realized his assessment had been correct. The building had once been a temple. Pinnacled towers rose from the river like masts of submerged ships. Part of the structure had sunk and broken away, tilting into the river beneath the waterline. The sections made of wood were obviously added at a much later date. A small settlement had grown up around the trading post. Thatch and reed huts were scattered along on the bank, and the smoke of cooking fires lay in plains across the water. Half-naked children, browned by the sun, played at the river's edge. People of both sexes and all ages moved among the huts, going about their daily business. Most of them were dressed in similar fashion to Cho Chan. A half-dozen wooden docks extended from the riverbank. Fishing boats, dugout canoes, and skiffs were tied up at them or being paddled out into the brown water of the Siem Reap. Cho Chan cocked his head toward the partially submerged building.
We have arrived at the trading center safely.
Kane resisted the impulse to tell him his evaluation might be premature. A group of Asian men lounged in the shade of a tarp tacked to a bamboo arbor near the entrance of the trading post. They were a bit too obvious in their lack of interest in Kane and his guide. All relatively young men, they were dressed much like the other people in the village, but they didn't exude an indolent personality. They reminded Kane of watchdogs, tense and ready to raise an alarm. Their poses of studied indifference and sideways glances toward Kane bespoke sect men.
Who did you say runs this trading post?
Oh, I didn't.
Right. And that's why I'm asking now.
His name is Zhou Zhu.
Zhou Zhu?
Yes, close enough. He is very well respected in these parts and will not cheat you.
I'm not worried about being cheated.
It rains several times a day this time of year.
Kane followed the little man up the stone steps leading to a beaded curtain that served as a door. The room they entered was large, with a high beamed ceiling, and it resembled nothing so much as a storage warehouse that had exploded due to the pressure of shoving far too many objects into it. Kane swept his gaze over the freestanding shelves, cases, racks, and bins. He could make no sense of the order in which the items were displayed, but he doubted there ever had been one. Shelves laden with ceramic jars, unidentifiable bits of rust-flaked metal, bins containing bolts and scraps of cloth, and freestanding racks holding a variety of small statues occupied almost every inch of floor space. Most of the figurines depicted a fat-bellied Buddha, but many others were worn by the weathering of the ages, so it was impossible to tell what they were meant to represent, animal, mineral, human, or otherwise. None of the items Kane glimpsed looked like viable trade goods. They more closely resembled a sampling of objects dug out of a garbage pit. The trading post apparently provided double service as a tavern or cafe. Two men wearing dark tunics and high-topped laced boots sat at a table near an open door that led out to a deck. One of them wore a scarlet headband with a strange spiral symbol embroidered on it. The other had a single loop of silver dangling from his left ear. Both looked to be in their early 20s. A fat man wearing a leather vest that concealed only a portion of his flabby torso made a lazy effort to oil the blade of a short sword. Its edge showed numerous V-shaped nicks. He nodded toward Cho Chan sleepily.
My friend Kane here has traveled a long way from a far-off territory. He has valuable treasures from his land to trade for quills.
The fat man looked at Kane with a sudden penetrating interest. His eyes darted to the pack strapped to his back, and then to the copperhead dangling from a lanyard stretched across his chest.
My name is Feng Ki. I review all the merchandise before any business is done.
I thought a guy named Zhou Tzu ran this operation.
Zhou Tzu is responsible for the disbursement of quills. He is far too busy to look at every piece of junk brought in by vagabonds.
Well, maybe you can tell me what quills are.
Of course. I would be happy to show the outlander.
Feng Qi turned toward a small desk set against the wall. Kane saw a narrow curtained doorway to the left of the man. Flickering light glowed feebly on the other side of it. The fat man opened a drawer, rummaged around inside it for a moment, then withdrew a long white feather, apparently one from the wing of a large waterfowl. He held it out toward Kane, who frowned in puzzlement. Then light glinted from a sprinkling of gold dust within the veins.
Now, do you understand our currency, outlander? You owe me 5 of those, or something of equal value.
The hard edge to his voice and the reversion to addressing him as outlander raised Kane's nape hairs. At the same instant, he heard the scuff of leather against floorboards. Wheeling on the ball of his right foot, he drove the toe of his left between the thighs of the man wearing the red headband. The man jackknifed at the waist, and Kane hammered him face first to the floor with a blow from his sin-eater-weighted forearm. He kicked him in the side of the head, rendering him unconscious. The man with the silver earring reached for Kane's backpack, securing a grip on a strap. He tried to wrestle Kane into a corner. Kane turned in the direction of the pull, grabbed a handful of tunic, and butted the man in the face with his forehead. The attacker's nose collapsed with a wet crunch of cartilage. Blood squirted from his nostrils as from a squashed tick. Staggering the width of the room, he stumbled out on the deck, where his heels snagged on a loose board and he collapsed heavily onto his back. Feng Qi swung at Kane with a notched knife. Kane shifted to the left, and the blade crashed into a shelf, causing small items to jump from it and thump to the floor. It took all of Kane's willpower to restrain himself from unleathering his sin-eater and deflating the man's swag belly with a 9mm tri-burst. Feng Qi lunged at him, and Kane lifted his arms, depending on the tough fabric of his shadow suit to turn the blade. As the nicked edge sawed uselessly against his sleeves, Kane drove a knee into the man's ballooning stomach. Feng Qi uttered a noise between a belch and a squawk and stepped backward. He managed to stay on his feet and renew his attack with the knife. Kane ducked a vicious roundhouse from the blade. The force of his unconnected blow turned Feng Qi completely, and Kane dropped, sweeping the fat man's feet out from under him with his right leg. As Feng Qi sat heavily on the floor, Kane bounced erect and hooked the corner of a freestanding cabinet with the fingers of his right hand and heaved. The man raised an arm and his lips parted. The heavy case crashed down atop him. Teeth bared and a silent snarl, Kane whirled toward Cho Chan, who made a shambling run around him toward the curtained doorway. Kane clotheslined him in the throat with his left arm, lifting him up and dropping him hard on his back. Bending over and grabbing him by a handful of his greasy hair, Kane jerked the little man to his feet and swung him around. The man squealed in pain, reaching up to pry Kane's fingers open.
You misunderstand, outlander!
That's my line, you sawed-off little turd! Why'd you bring me here? You've got about 3 seconds to talk, or you won't tell anything to anybody ever again.
Despite the temptation, Kane had no intention of killing the man, but he knew such a bluff would work well with a sleazy con artist like Cho Chan.
You said you saw the girl, Kane. I sought only to help you.
It's Kane again now, is it? Let's go back to Outlander, and back to the girl.
Kane!
Kane's head swiveled so fast, his neck tendons twinged in protest. Nora Pinnock stood before the curtained doorway, her right arm supported by a sling. The left leg of her bodysuit was torn, showing a white, crimson-splotched bandage on the thigh beneath. Although her hair was in disarray and her eyes dark-ringed, she appeared to be in fairly good condition. Kane shoved Cho-Chan away from him. The bent little man stumbled backward, tripped over a fallen statue, and fell heavily. Kane paid him no attention, as with two long strides he crossed the room to where Nora stood.
Nora, are you all right?
She smiled wanly, touching her arm in its sling and shifting her left leg.
It's not quite as bad as it looks. Dislocated arm, gash on my thigh. I have been well cared for.
By whom?
By me, Mr. Kane.
The quiet male voice floating out of the doorway was fluid, his English free of any hint of an accent. It was as if the speaker had learned the language from a computer's speech program, because there was a certain sterility of tone, an almost machine-like lack of tonal inflections. Kane snapped up his sin-eater, pointing it at the shadowy figure standing just behind Nora.
Who the hell are you?
You may kill me, but that will do you no good. You will never find your other two friends.
You didn't answer my question.
The man stepped forward into the light, thrusting aside the curtain. He was almost a head taller than Nora Penick, his clean-shaved face impassive and hard, the softness of youth long vanished from it. His eyes, narrowed by the Asian epicanthic fold, glittered with a cold determination. Jet-black hair hung loose about his lean face in a tangle of witch locks. A long, thin white scar crooked down from his hairline to bisect his right eyebrow. He was a striking figure in his bright red Chinese robe, embroidered with heavy gold thread in dragon forms and tiny figures of Mandarin nobility from a past epoch of Asian history. The high collar and velvet-trimmed belled sleeves didn't detract from the charismatic force he radiated. A tigerish force burned within him, the fire of a dangerous professional warrior with a purpose. The gaze Nora directed toward him was one of complete adoration.
My name is Zhou Tzu, General Zhou Tzu.
Kane's finger hovered over the sin-eater's trigger stud, his eyes slitting in an effort to conceal his confusion. At that second, the tramp of running feet filled the big room. Kane turned slightly as the young men he had seen lounging outside rushed into the trading post, enclosing him in a semicircle. They moved swiftly, with military precision. The manner in which they wielded small, wicked-looking subguns, aiming the bores only on him, showed they had been exceptionally well-trained in the use of small arms. For a long, stretched-out moment of tension, the tableau held, everyone frozen in place. Then General Zhou Tzu stepped to one side, gesturing toward the doorway.
Some tea, Mr. Kane.
Colonel Puyang stood on the balcony of the high tower, gazing at the vast city spread out below the gray skies. His mood was equally gray as he tried not to think about the whereabouts of Zhou Tzu or two of the strangers. The start of the rainy season always put him in a bad mood. Persistent downpours would turn the fields outside of the walls into quagmires. The foundation of some of the older buildings had sunk deep into the ground, and they suffered from intermittent flooding. At least it was a clean, nourishing rain, which would feed the crops and the citizens of Angkor Thom, and in turn draw new citizens to repopulate the ancient city. He found the thought a very small, very cold comfort. It was best if the people remained hungry. Angkor Thom was a city of towers and spires and empty legends, Puyang reflected, ruled by a myth in the form of a child. But that would change, he thought. It must change. He turned, straightening his uniform tunic, and walked to the round table upon which lay a square of rice paper. The table was huge and ornately carved after the fashion of Imperial Khmer. A golden candelabrum, whose branches bore the likenesses of seven intertwined cobras, illuminated the red wax seal at the bottom edge of the paper.
You have yet to sign the decree, Your Glory.
A figure stirred upon the high-backed chair elevated atop a dais.
I have my doubts, Colonel, about the efficacy of this decree. How will it help?
We have given the people such a grand and gracious capital for our empire, yet the ingratitude, the rebellious attitudes are still on the rise. We cannot risk losing all we have built over the years.
He gestured dramatically as if wishing to embrace the chamber. No expense had been spared to render the vaulted room a seat of luxury. Walls of damp, rough stone were hung with richly embroidered tapestries. The cold flagstone floor was covered by thick, soft carpets of many colors and complex designs. A tabaret of gilded wood, decorated with sensuous groupings of meticulously detailed new dancing girls, held silver platters of various viands and liquors.
I fear there is nothing to do but increased the public executions.
We are approaching the harvest season, and there is already a serious food shortage in some territories. My people...
Our people, your glory. What you do not yet understand is how our people are seriously lacking in basic intelligence. For the most part, they are simple fisherfolk and peasants, farmers, grubbers of the soil. We cannot rely on them to act logically in the best interests of the Empire. They must be coerced. And sometimes, unfortunately, instilling fear is the only way. Remember the inducement offered by your late beloved mother? It offered several solutions to the alleged famine, yet they persisted in agitating and ignoring Imperial wisdom. Surely your glory finds the situation as intolerable as I do.
Yes.
Puyang repressed a smile of triumph. He moved to the base of the dais and extended a hand. He found the scent of Kumudvati tantalizing. She smelled of fresh morning flowers. She smelled of his future, of power. Kumudvati took his hand, his spatulate thumb nearly covering the entire area of her palm. She allowed herself to be led down from the dais. She was tiny, but her proportions were perfect on a minuscule scale. Her skin was pale amber in a complexion which contrasted sharply with the multitude of gems scattered about her near-naked body. Uncut rubies gleamed in both earlobes, and alternating strings of white and black pearls hung in multiple loops from her slender neck, concealing her small breasts. Bracelets of pure gold jingled on her arms and wrists. Her only garment consisted of a red silken clout hanging from a delicate gold chain about her hips. It flowed down between her thighs, almost to her knees. On her tiny feet, she wore soft leather sandals with long thongs cross-tied around her calves. Kumudvati's glossy black hair was carefully brushed back, and it streamed down her back like a cloak. A jeweled coif drew it away from her face, so her hair would not obscure the glittering gold scale design painted on and around her eyelids. Surrounded by sweeping lashes, her eyes were a soft, luminous brown, as limpid as a doe's.
If they ignore our sound wisdom, then they must suffer the consequences. We shall have 4 additional public executions in the next week, one from each of the most rebellious villages. All you need do is sign the order.
Kumudvati glanced down at the paper and nibbled her underlip nervously.
The people to be executed, are they here in the city?
Yes, we have them in custody, your glory.
Colonel, I have been told there is no actual famine, no real food shortage. I have heard that farms have been razed, paddies destroyed, storage bins fired...
Your glory, I made 2 vows to your mother before she died, to guide you with my counsel and to revive the might of the Khmer Empire by any means possible. 1 vow cannot be fulfilled without the other. Do you understand that?
Yes, Colonel.
He pushed a quill pen into her hand.
Then sign the order, your glory, and permit me to continue honoring your mother's last wishes.
Kumudvati stared at the paper, then at the pen, and swiftly scribbled a string of flowing characters above the wax seal.
Very good, your glory.
He reached for the quill, but she spun away, letting it fall to the floor. Colonel Puyang lifted the decree and carefully blew on the signature to dry the ink.
What about the 3 strangers, apparently from some alien land, that were taken prisoner?
Puyang paused, his lips pursed, and cast the girl a glare meant to silence her, but she stood with her back to him.
Apparently is the key word, your glory.
But there were 3 strangers captured?
We captured only 1. I have been scouring all the outlying villages for any sign of the other 2.
And if they are from an alien land, why do we assume they are enemies?
I don't assume that. But they may have knowledge useful to us and to the Empire.
What kind of knowledge? Magic or science?
Perhaps both. And both are dangerous in the wrong hands.
And what of Zhou Tzu? What of the general?
The colonel's hand went reflexively to finger the mass of scar tissue on the right side of his face.
What of him?
Your report claimed he and his followers ambushed your patrol. How do you know he does not have the other strangers in hand and is already tapping that useful knowledge?
Colonel Puyang wasn't sure, but he thought he detected an undercurrent of sarcasm in the girl's question. He struggled to keep his temper in check. The suspicion he was involved in the death of Kumudvati's mother was restricted to very few in the court, but no one dared to lodge a formal accusation as long as he stayed in the daughter's favor. If word of the Devinaga's death leaked out to the commoners, a revolt was a very real possibility. At best, people would desert Angkor Thom, fleeing back to their villages in the jungle. There could be no empire without subjects. However, if the girl should die mysteriously, he could not rely on the Cobra Guard to protect him from reprisals from the nobles in on the gambit to pass off Kumudvati's daughter as the original Devinaga. Far too many junior officers coveted his rank and position. Living as the consort of a princess, of a demigoddess, was an exciting prospect for many men. But Puyang knew if he were to play that role, he would have to force the girl to accept him in it over a period of time. At the moment, she was still mourning the loss of her mother and looked to him as a counselor, not a potential suitor.
We should not be concerned with Zhou Zhu. Many of his men are dead, and he poses no immediate threat to us.
And the Magickers? Were they not also involved in the event you reported?
The Magickers are fools. They are thieves. They live like fugitives. Your mother was right to banish them when they failed to harness the gift of the Naga left for us beneath our palace.
Kumudvati nodded as if she expected the response, and she stepped toward the double doors at the far end of the chamber.
And is that why you have imprisoned one of the strangers? You hope he will have the means to harness the gift?
Who told you that?
The girl cast a glance over one bare shoulder, and Puyang felt a quiver of unease in the pit of his stomach. For an instant, the iron will of her mother could be glimpsed glittering in her dark eyes.
You just did, Colonel.
With a tinkle of baubles, Kumudvati swept out of the chamber. Puyang stared after her, clenching his fists and his teeth. The Devinaga had just revealed a hint of her mother's strength beneath the callow covering of a child. The flickering trace of her mother's resolve didn't frighten him. But for a microsecond, Kumudvati's face had rippled away, and he saw Zhou Zhu's dark eyes piercing him to his very soul. Icy fingers of terror closed around his heart when he realized Kumudvati was not just her mother's daughter, but her father's as well. Brewster Filboid's cell was a miserable affair, the stone walls blackened by years of water incursion and dead lichens. The floor wasn't exactly mud, but it wasn't dry either. The scatter of moldy straw served as an unsatisfactory substitute for a carpet. A circular hole high in the left-hand wall provided the only source of light and ventilation. In a far corner, water continually dripped. There were no furnishings, so Filboid sat on the floor, hugging his knees, and tried to dwell on anything but his pain and his predicament. Neither was possible. Recollecting his impassioned plea to Brigid to be allowed to be part of the mission, he mimicked himself.
Aw, come on, what's the worst that can happen? I might be able to help if anything goes wrong. Yeah, I can get shot in the head and captured and thrown into a stinking cell by a bunch of Asian maniacs wearing snake heads. But hey, I might be able to help if anything goes wrong.
He shook his head, disgusted with himself and his situation. Then a hammer blow fell within his skull and he bit back a cry of pain. He gingerly probed the edge of the blood-crusted bandage wound around his head. He still wasn't sure of the entire sequence of events that had followed the interfacer transit. Filboid recalled hearing the staccato drumming of autofire, the gloom lighting up with strobing spears of flame. Shouts, yells, and a cry of alarm from Brigid filled his ears. Then something hot and hard smashed across his forehead and sent him flailing backward. He felt himself falling, suddenly blinded by a fiery wetness. Then it was as if he were drowning in an incredibly thick fog. His next recollection was of pain and sunlight pouring down through the round hole in the cell wall. Although his head wound had been treated by wrapping it with an unguent-soaked bandage, it throbbed in cadence with his pulse. His vision was blurred, and by touching his face he realized his glasses were missing. Although it was difficult to move at first, Filboid tottered to his feet, stumbled over to the wooden door, and peered through the barred window. He saw nothing but flickering torchlight and twisting stone corridors. He had previously called out a number of times, but had never received a response. Dizzy, weak, and slightly nauseous, Filboid figured he had no option but to sit on the floor and wait for something to happen. By carefully examining the wound on his forehead by touch, he concluded he had been struck a glancing blow by a ricocheting bullet. The front of his bodysuit was caked and sticky with blood, although his face had been cleansed of it. He dozed for a time, but a scuffling of feet awakened him. Through the window in the door, he glimpsed the flickering blossom of torchlight. Philboyd rose on unsteady legs and made his way to the door, peering through the aperture. Two Asian men wearing bizarre metal helmets resembling the heads of cobras appeared, moving sideways with handguns aimed at a line of chained, shuffling men. There were four of them, shackled at wrist and ankle. They wore only tatters of clothes, and all of them were covered in bruises and bloody abrasions, as if they had been severely beaten. Behind them marched another armed man, holding aloft a guttering torch that stank abominably of fish oil. One of the snake-helmeted men noticed Philboyd watching from the door and shouted unintelligible words, waving his pistol toward him. Despite the language barrier, Philboyd understood perfectly and retreated out of sight. He heard the jingle of keys, the clank of the chains, the thump of doors closing, and finally the tramp of marching feet. After that, utter silence draped the catacombs for what seemed like a very long time. Hunger and thirst assailed him. Lice abounded in the cell and were attracted to his blood-caked clothing. At first, Philboyd just scratched and cursed, but after a while, he passed the time by plucking them from his body and crushing them between the nails of his thumb and forefinger. He was so engrossed he almost didn't hear the key turning in the lock. He glanced up as the door was pulled outward. A young Asian man, barely into his teens, stepped in cautiously, carrying a wooden trencher containing a stew that exuded a strong fish smell. He carried a clay jug of water in the other hand. Looking past him out the doorway, Philboyd saw a snake-helmeted guard standing in the corridor holding a small submachine gun. The youth placed the food and water on the floor and backed away, never making eye contact, not even when Philboyd thanked him. By the time the door was closed and relocked, Philboyd was downing the container of stew. The taste was mid-range revolting, but the food was filling, and he saw no reason to offer a critique. Within a few minutes, the door opened again, and the young man returned to remove the containers. Shortly after that, light faded from the window, and Philboyd spent his first full, miserable night in the damp, dank cell. Fortunately, the air, though clammy, wasn't cold, and he didn't share his quarters with any vermin other than the lice. They were quite sufficient. Although he dreaded the dawn and what the new day might bring, he was accustomed to living in a degree of fear. His many years on the moon base had been little more than a series of terrifying pursuits, of ambushes, of his friends and colleagues dying one by one. Compared to the fear evoked by Carnobots and the Faceless Furies, little Cambodian men wearing snake regalia didn't even rate. When sunrise arrived, nothing happened except that his cell became almost unbearably humid. He shouted through the barred window of the door for water, but only once did he receive a reply, a stream of angry-sounding gibberish yelled from a place outside his range of vision. The language barrier seemed insurmountable. The only way Philboyd measured the passage of time was by the intensity of sunlight shafting through the cell window and the arrival at midday of his daily ration of fish swill and water. When he calculated his third full day of imprisonment was drawing to a close, with cool shadows crawling across the damp floor, he suddenly detected an odor that wasn't the fishy stink of the torches or of his stew. He heard the jingling clank of a key in the lock, and the door swung open. Philboyd expected to see either his serving boy or a snake-helmeted guard standing there. Instead, a heavily muffled figure stood watching him from the doorway. A cloak of loosely woven silk fell almost to the floor, completely concealing the person's body. A white veil secured to a coif above each ear masked the face. But Brewster Philboyd knew the cloaked figure was that of a woman, if not by the rich scent of perfume, then by the heavily mascaraed eyelids with the delicate gold scale pattern painted around them. He also received the impression she was a woman of some importance, despite her height of less than 5 feet. Slowly, he pushed himself to his feet, knee joints cracking. Behind her, Philboyd saw an armed guard standing watchfully against the wall, a subgun held across his chest. The woman spoke first, very softly, in the fluid language he didn't comprehend. He shook his head.
"I'm sorry. I don't speak your tongue, or understand it."
The dark eyes above the edge of the veil widened in surprise, then flicked up and down his body. She spoke again, very slowly.
"English! You speak English! So you are from an alien land. What is your name?"
"Brewster."
"Booster?"
Close enough.
How did you arrive here, Busta? Did you come by flying machine?
It's not easy to explain.
Science or magic?
Pardon?
Did you use science or magic to come here?
Science.
Brewster Filboid immediately regretted committing himself. If she requested an explanation of the interphaser, then his description would no doubt sound like magic to her. She nodded as if satisfied by his answer.
Oh, that is good. I have a need of a man of science. Are you such?
Filboid could only nod numbly. The woman started to step farther into the cell, but she turned at the sound of running, scuffling feet in the corridor. One of the ugliest men Filboid had ever seen grabbed her by a handful of her cloak and hauled her roughly into the hallway, literally hurling her into the arms of the frightened guard.
Hey!
The scarred man spun to face him, shouting incomprehensibly. Filboid didn't understand the words, but he perfectly grasped the tone. The man was both frightened and angry. The man feared him and what he might have said to the veiled girl. Jotsu extended a small cup and saucer toward Kane.
It is a special blend grown only here, Mr. Kane, and one of the few civilized customs in which I still indulge. Tea time.
No, thank you.
His eyebrows were lifted like dark wings over amused almond eyes.
It is not poisoned, Mr. Kane, or drugged. You are far too valuable for me to waste you in such a fashion.
As Jotsu's eyebrows rose, Kane's drew down. He cast a sideways glance at Nora Penick.
I have learned the General's word is sufficient in all things. You may trust him.
The room was dimly lit. Silk tapestries depicting scenes from myths covered the windowless walls, a crawl with tigers, dragons, archers, and marching warriors armed with swords. Jotsu and Nora sat side by side on thick pillows before a long, low table. A tendril of gray smoke curled from the single tea candle floating in a clay bowl of water. Kane stood scowling down at the two people and the proffered cup of tea. Then he flexed his wrist tendons, holstering the sin-eater with a rasp of metal against leather and plastic. He performed the motion with a little flourish, as a demonstration of how much control he exerted over his weapon and how quickly it could return to his hand if he perceived the need for it. He sank down on a pillow directly across from General Jotsu and took the cup of tea.
As I understand it, Mr. Kane, you hold no military rank in your own country, although you perform military duties and live in a military base.
Kane took a tentative sip of the tea and found the flavor rich, with just a hint of a bittersweet aftertaste.
And you? You call yourself a general. A general of what?
I am what once was known as a warlord, Mr. Kane. A relic of a very old, very obsolete resistance movement against imperial tyranny. I am the last of the line.
Line of what, exactly?
A line of men who act as yang to yin, as north to south, as winter to summer. The movement I lead provides the necessary balance in our microcosm here.
Balance?
Our doctrine, our laws, Mr. Kane. The laws of Manu, which deal with the ancient Vedic doctrine of world ages, the Yugas. Manu indicates that a period of 24,000 years consists of a series of four Yugas, or ages, each shorter and spiritually darker than the last. In the mythology of our land, a fabled dawn time existed in the distant past, when human beings had direct contact with the divine intelligence emanating from Brahma, the seat of creative power and intelligence in the cosmos. As the teachings tell, Kali, the creator-destroyer goddess, will appear at the end of the Kali Yuga and sweep away the wasted detritus of a spirit-dead humanity, making way for a new cycle of light and peace.
There are some who feel that already happened 2 centuries ago.
As do I. As I thought Kumudvati did. Apparently, she has decided to oppose the cycle. The turning of the wheel.
Kane glanced over at Nora. She looked pale and wan, but she seemed perfectly at ease at the side of the strange man.
General, Nora apparently told you something about where we came from and what we do.
I did. I saw no reason to withhold anything from the man who saved my life.
Kane shifted his gaze back to Jotsu.
Then maybe you'd better tell the man who saved your life how I hate people talking to me in esoterica.
As you wish, Mr. Kane. Let us be more direct. You have not asked about your other friends.
I expect you'll tell me about them when you please. I'm not as easy to impress as Nora, and I won't play guessing games with you.
You do not wonder if they are still alive?
They had better be.
You threaten me? Miss Pennock told me you were brave and intelligent, but prone toward reckless behavior. I can see she was right.
Kane opened his mouth to voice a profane retort, but Jotsu raised an imperious hand.
We are both soldiers in a cause, Mr. Kane. One does what is needed to fulfill a duty or to discharge an obligation, or one is no more important to the cycle of life than a grain of sand in the Gobi. As soldiers, you and I can make common cause and perhaps fulfill our respective duties.
To cover his growing confusion, Kane took another sip of tea. He glanced over at Nora.
How did the general save your life?
Troopers of the Devinaga attacked us shortly after we made the phase transit. Another faction was involved as well, called the Magickers. They were dragging me off when Providence sent the general to intervene. He rescued me.
Who was dragging you off, the Magickers or the troopers?
The Cobra Guard had her, and her male companion.
They managed to get Brewster to anchor Tom, from what we have heard.
And Brigid?
We have heard nothing of her from the city. It is reasonable to assume that the Magickers have her and your interphaser.
So you told him about the interphaser?
I did.
It sounds like a singularly extraordinary device.
Why were you, the Cobra Guard, and the Magickers all in the same place at the same time?
The man's shoulders lifted beneath his red robe in a negligent shrug.
Who can say? Serendipity? The will of the gods? Karma? Speaking for myself, I just survived an assassination attempt by Colonel Pu Yang, commander of the Cobra Guard. A number of my most devoted soldiers were killed. They had violated the borders, and so I trailed the murderers responsible.
So, Nora, maybe you can explain to me why you think you're better off in the hands of a warlord than those of the Magickers or this Devinaga. Why are you so sure he doesn't deserve to be assassinated?
I am right here, Mr. Kane. You might ask me.
Fine. Answer the question, then.
The fact that you and Miss Pennock are still alive and unharmed should be a satisfactory answer.
You already said I was valuable to you. As what?
Miss Pennock told me about her friends, about you and her conviction that you, and quite possibly others, would come looking for them. I gambled that I would find the party from Cerberus before the other players in the game. That is how you came to meet Cho Chan.
I figured as much. What game are you talking about?
The general leaned back, closing his eyes for a moment, as if he were viewing the past.
Perhaps I chose the wrong term. It has only been since Miss Pennock's arrival that I have had the opportunity to speak English since I learned it many years ago.
Learned it from whom?
Not whom, but what. As child of noble birth, I was sent to a monastery far from here to learn all that the monks could teach me. They had a machine. You would call it a PC, which taught me several different languages, English among them. The PC also taught me how to play a game known as chess.
I see. As far as you're concerned, we're engaged in a chess match with this Devinaga of yours and the Magickers.
Precisely. The Devinaga is apparently making a gambit to centralize control of Cambodia and so to create a ruling hegemony. In blatant violation of our traditional roles in obeying the laws of Yuga. Therefore, I have no choice but to embark on a gambit of my own to restore the balance.
I don't understand.
What do you know of my country, Mr. Kane?
Almost nothing.
My people were a noble race who honored their place under the stars and built the world's most profound temple city, that of Angkor Thom. What is even more profound, it seems, is the complete disappearance of the very civilization that built these temples, with no trace of where they went and no trace of their continuing their culture anywhere else.
Where do they come from? Maybe that will tell you where they went.
That is almost as deep a mystery. According to an account written in 916 CE by the Arab trader Abu Zaid, the Maharaja of Java once sailed his fleet up the Mekong River to the Khmer capital for the express purpose of capturing and decapitating the Cambodian ruler. Historians have ascribed the construction of several of central Java's Buddhist temples to the Selendra dynasty of kings that ruled during the late 8th and early 9th centuries. So perhaps the Javanese originally settled this country. But in 802 AD, Jayavarman, the founding king of Cambodian's Angkor civilization, appeared. He participated in a ceremony that involved the installation of a linga, the phallic emblem of the Hindu deity Shiva, on top of Mount Kulen north of Angkor. This act launched the Khmer Empire and royal dynasty that flourished for more than 600 years.
Is this Jayavarman whom you claim descent from?
Not exactly. The inauguration of King Jayavarman established the exalted position of Devaraja, literally God King. According to Miss Pennick, that is a concept that has been revived with some success in your own country.
The barons aren't kings, much less gods.
Yes. Each succeeding Khmer ruler during the Angkor period of Cambodian history followed Jayavarman's example by building a sanctuary for the cult of the Devaraja in the form of a pyramid mountain, either natural or artificial, that was located at the very center of the Khmer ruler's realm.
Why?
Have you ever heard of geomancy?
Yes. I can't say I understand it.
The goal of the ancient Khmer architect was to harmonize the microcosmic forces that govern life in the human world with the macrocosmic forces that rule over the realm of the gods. According to this point of view, the extent to which any building fails to conform with an architectural plan designed to mirror the perfection of the cosmos can make the difference between a living structure that will allow benevolent spiritual forces to enter and take up residence and a structure that is considered to be blocked, closed off, or dead.
What spiritual forces are you talking about?
The Naga, the forebears of the Khmers.
I was afraid you'd say that. I was briefed about them before I embarked. These Naga of yours sound very much like the Anunnaki. Nora over there could tell you a few things about them, or at least some of the technology they left behind on the moon.
I already told him, and from what the General told me, it sounds as if the Naga left some of their own technology behind, or beneath Angkor Wat.
What makes you say that?
Naga is a term used to describe unseen beings associated with water and fluid energy, and also with persons having powerful animal-like qualities, or an impressive animal with human qualities, deities of the primal ocean and of mountain springs, also spirits of earth and the realm beneath it. In the mythology of my land, Naga are primarily serpent beings living near flowing water, fluid energy.
The entire city of Angkor Thom was built near rivers, over underground springs and reservoirs. The city was dedicated to the worship of Naga. Where there is flowing water, there is energy. The art of geomancy is based on Earth's life energy flowing the path of water. Where water flows, life goes. The Naga apparently taught the Khmer people this and how to channel it.
How so?
I'm only speculating based on what the General has told me, but what lies beneath Angkor Wat is a kind of channeling mechanism for the electromagnetic field concentrated in the city.
For every type of energy, there are positive and negative charges. The ideal situation is one where a balance between the two is established and maintained.
Yin and yang. And you represented the balance?
With the cooperation of the Devi Naga, of course.
And, of course, the balance has now tipped into the negative.
I'm glad you understand.
I think I do. You said it was a chess game, right?
Yes.
And you expect us to join the game?
I see no other option. Not if you wish to be reunited with your friends.
What pieces do Nora and I represent in the warlord's gambit? Knights or pawns?
General Jotsu smiled faintly, a slightly amused, almost pitying smile.
Miss Pennick has been removed from the board, Mr. Kane. As for what chessmen you will play, I expect you will prove that to be once we begin our journey downriver. But you may take some solace in the fact that I do not intend to sacrifice you needlessly.
The road cutting through the fields was muddy from the rainstorm the night before. The heavy footfalls of the two elephants made an incessant squishing that Bridget found to be more than a little nerve-wracking after a few hours. She was also slightly queasy due to the swaying gait of the creature upon whose back she was perched. She attributed at least 80% of her nausea to the dried fish and fruit that had served as her pre-dawn breakfast. The saddle pad beneath her provided an unsatisfactory protective layer between human skin and bristlebrush pachyderm hair sprouting from its gray, wrinkled hide. The thick, musky odor the creature exuded didn't help much either. Brigid had seen pics of elephants, of course, but the photographic representations of the animals didn't do justice to the massive, smelly reality of the Asian elephant, the Elephas maximus. The elephant she shared with Brother Javalara was named Maya. A female and only 3 years old, she had not attained her full height, and like most Asian elephants, her ears were far smaller than her African counterparts. Her face bore a large, unpigmented patch between her wise eyes, a pale pink against the gray. Brigid reached up under the edge of her turban and wiped her perspiration-slick brow. The air was already hot and humid for such an early hour, and with no shade available, the heat was quickly growing unbearable. She wore a draping garment similar to a sari, but it left her arms bare, and she feared they would soon burn in the intense sunlight. Her rolled-up shadow suit was in a saddlebag lying between her and Javalara. He had insisted she shed the skin-tight black garment because it would draw far more attention from passers-by than the simple robe and breeches favored by loggers. Farmers and peasants wouldn't spread the word of three loggers riding on elephants through their territory, but they would certainly gossip about spying a flame-haired woman in basic black. That gossip would spread to the ears of informers in the pay of the Cobra Guard. Although a little suspicious, Brigid did as the chief magicker bade her to do. She didn't perceive that she had many options available to her. The interphaser rested inside a crate on the elephant ridden by Yasavar. Therefore, the magickers were the only hope she had of secretly entering Angkor Thom. Both Yasavar and Javalara had made cryptic references to acquiring a much faster method of transportation than elephants, but they had refused to elaborate. In the field to her left, Brigid watched a flock of birds pecking at what she first assumed was a pitifully ineffective scarecrow. Then, when she realized the tattered figure hanging from the T-framework was the body of a man, her nausea redoubled. Javalara followed her gaze.
Executed at Colonel Puyang's orders.
For what reason?
His crops failed, as did many others in this vicinity.
Crucifixion seems a rather harsh penalty for bad luck.
Puyang didn't believe it was bad luck. He thought the farmers here were deliberately destroying their crops, harvesting just enough to keep themselves fed so they could starve out the people in Angkor Thom. He forced the farmers to turn over their entire harvest, and then burn their fields so they would be solely dependent on their own food distributed from the city.
Will no one cut down the man and give him a burial?
That would mean crucifixion for whoever did it. If the Cobra Guard is unable to find the people who actually did the deed, they would pick someone at random from one of the farms and execute him.
This Colonel Puyang and the Cobra Guard sound as though they would be right at home in my country.
Javalara looked over his shoulder at her.
Perhaps now you understand why we so desperately need your help.
Well, I wouldn't mind seeing this colonel of yours put out of business.
Such is our main objective.
But it's not mine.
Of course. Your goal is to find your friends and return home. But you cannot achieve your objective without our help. And we cannot achieve ours without yours.
Convenient how it works out that way. Some might see it as a nice and neat bit of manipulation. I'd call it blatant opportunism, or blackmail.
Javalara opened his mouth to reply, then closed it with a snap. Craning his neck, he scanned the sky, his entire body tensed. Maya's plodding gait slowed a trifle, and she curled her trunk, trumpeting briefly.
What is it?
Keep your head down. A Vimana is coming.
A Vimana?
Brigid stared at him, nonplussed. Then, despite what the man said, she looked up, her gaze sweeping across the sky. At the same time, she heard a faint melodic hum. Slightly to the east of their path, she saw a shape gleaming silver against the blue sky. It hovered above a tree line a quarter of a mile or so distant.
A flying craft from Angkor Thom. A very old design dating back to the days of the Rama, as chariots of the gods. What the Vimanas are used for here isn't quite as grand.
Brigid knew what Vimanas were reputed to be, at least in legend. The ship hove closer, and she saw its configurations resembled nothing so much as a bewinged throwing dart. The hull gleamed like mercury in the sunlight. The craft looked graceful, almost beautiful, like a chrome-plated dragonfly, its wings glistening with the morning dew. The faint hum changed in timbre, lowering to a deep rhythmic throb. Two streaks of fire lanced downward from the Vimana's underbelly. Clumps of jungle erupted into smoke and flame. The boom of the double explosion sounded like a fist beating on a muffled kettle drum.
What the hell?
They must have located a paddy. They fired missiles with incendiary warheads to destroy the crop.
This is no way to run a country.
The pointed prow of the Vimana swung about, giving the impression the craft was questing for a target. Then it lanced across the sky, skimming over the fields directly toward them.
We've been spotted.
What do we do? Just carry on like nothing is wrong?
No. They would wonder why we weren't frightened. Crouch low, as if you are supplicating yourself to the Vimana.
The elephant lurched to a halt, as did Yasavar's. The two animals shifted from foot to foot in nervous agitation. They didn't like the sight of the airship soaring toward them. Neither did Bridget, but when the craft drew closer, she saw it was a poor thing in comparison to the Manta ships. It seemed to struggle across the sky rather than glide, despite the ribbed wings stretched out on either side of it. The Vimana was less than 20 feet long, the wingspan perhaps double that. The fuselage was a patchwork of metal plates and lacquered wood. A port in the center of its undercarriage gaped open, and she glimpsed the hollow muzzle of a handheld rocket launcher. The engine droned as the craft dropped in altitude. Javalara bent over Maya's broad skull, hands clasped at the back of his head. Bridget followed suit, leaning against him. The sound of the Vimana's engine suddenly increased in volume and rose in pitch. For a second, a shadow blotted out the sunlight. The craft roared over the elephants, probably at the highest rate of speed of which it was capable. The downdraft buffeted them, and Bridget nearly tumbled from Maya's back. She clutched Javalara by the waist in order to keep seated. Yasavar's elephant lifted its trunk and bleated indignantly as dust and plant scraps swirled about them.
Are they coming back?
No. They are resuming their search pattern. They had that little joke. Those missiles are hard to come by, and they won't waste them on us.
Ha ha. I had no idea the level of technology was so high here.
There are only two such craft in existence, at least in operation. The Cobra Guard uses one.
What about the other?
Yasavar didn't answer immediately. After a moment of hesitation, he cut his eyes over to Javalara, who responded.
The other is in our possession. That is one reason we are so hunted by the Cobra Guard.
Oh, hell, why didn't you tell me that in the first place?
It's a question of security, Baptiste. If you were captured by the Cobra Guard before we reached the Vimana, you might have told them about it. We still have several miles to travel before we reach it. Then it will carry us the rest of the way to Angarton.
Bridget glared at the back of the man's turbaned head for a long moment. Then she uttered a resigned sigh. Javalara was right. At sharply spoken commands from the men, the elephants began trudging down the road again. As the animals rounded a bend, they shied momentarily from two nearly naked boys who crept from the brush line. The taller of the pair, who looked to be about 10 years old, wore a dirty strip of cloth over his right eye. He held the smaller boy by the right hand, or rather the stump where his hand had once been. Both of them were scratched and very brown, their limbs stick thin and bellies swollen from malnutrition. Bridget guessed they were brothers. The taller boy held out a wooden bowl.
Food! Quills! Food!
I am sorry. We are a family of poor woodsmen who cannot spare quills, and you are a long way from any place where you might find charity.
We do not wish to venture too close to the city today.
Javalara tossed down 2 sealed packets of cheese, fruit, and dried fish.
And why is that?
The smaller boy looked over to his side, eyes fixed on the package of food his brother tore open.
5 men are to be hanged today.
For what crime? Not for any crime. As an example, one of them is said to be an outlander who defiled the person of the Devi Naga.
Bridget stiffened, but Javalara turned toward her, a warning finger to his lips.
Do not draw attention to yourself.
Where are your parents?
Dead. An example was made of them and their farm.
The elephants plodded onward.
We have all seen more than our share of examples. Long past time they came to a stop.
Bridget glanced back twice at the 2 naked boys stuffing their mouths with the simple food, as if it were ambrosia.
Are these public executions held often?
Too often. They're intended to keep the people fearful and docile.
In my experience, it frequently has the opposite effect.
Not frequently enough, I fear. We had hoped the warlord, General Jotsu, would become aware of these depredations and intervene. But so far he has done nothing.
Is he the enemy of the Cobra Guard?
Only if they cross the borders into his country. They have apparently done so, yet he has not retaliated. It is a frustration and a mystery.
He doesn't sound like much of a warlord.
Yasavar smiled slightly.
It is a hereditary title, as is his hostility to the Devi Naga. But he does not fight her because it would upset the balance.
He safeguards the borders from incursions by Vietnamese and Laotian bandits.
I see. Will we arrive in Angkor Thom in time for the executions?
Perhaps.
Will we be able to enter the city dressed as loggers?
In this guise, we can move freely through the land, since we perform a valuable service. Although if the Cobra Guard learns our real identities, they would be swift to act against us. We would join the ranks of the condemned and be three more examples.
Doesn't anybody ever try to stop these executions?
It would mean instant death for any who tried.
Not necessarily.
What do you mean?
Not answering, Brigid reached into the saddlebag and withdrew her TP-9 auto pistol. Brother Javalara, putting her on her honor she would accompany them to Angkor Thom, had returned the weapon before they began their journey. Brigid detested guns in principle, but she wasn't so blinkered by dislike that she was ignorant of circumstances where they had their uses. Swiftly, she examined it, popping out the magazine and testing the slide mechanism. It worked smoothly, and she reinserted the ammo clip. At the metallic mechanical sounds, Javalara hitched around the elephant's back and regarded her with quizzical eyes.
You apparently didn't hear or understand what I said. It would be death for any who tried to interfere in the executions.
Brigid smiled at him, a cold, stitched-on kind of smile she had seen on Cain's lips more than once.
And you apparently didn't hear or understand what I said, so I'll repeat it. Not necessarily.
The early morning sunlight shone down upon the deck of the wooden barge in an intricately dappled pattern, filtered as it was through the leafy boughs intertwined over the river. Cain stood at the starboard rail, studying the terrain on either bank. It was all thick foliage, growing right down to the water's edge. The prow of the flat-bottomed boat cleaved through the rippling water with barely a sound. At the stern, the steersman lay drowsily over the sweep. He was a round-shouldered man with a scarlet kerchief tied around his head, which lent him a piratical air. General Zhou Tzu and the other six members of the little barge's crew stood forward at their morning meal. Once or twice, Cain heard half-whispered words as they conferred, and furtive glances were cast his way. The heat was cloyingly oppressive. Sweat gathered on Cain's face. His shirt clung to his back. The air was thick with moisture. He silently swore at himself for allowing Zhou Tzu to persuade him to adopt less conspicuous clothing than a black shadow suit. He wore a white sleeveless cotton shirt, baggy trousers, sandals, and a broad-brimmed hat made of woven straw. He knew he looked ridiculous, but without a mirror he could only guess at just how ridiculous. However, he had refused to part with the pack, which contained the items taken from the manta. It, as well as his sin-eater and copperhead, lay on the deck at his feet. The barge had been floating slowly downriver since before the sky had turned golden with dawn. So far, it had passed little more than jungle, although Cain had glimpsed the tawny, striped form of a tiger drinking at the water's edge. The huge cat had not raised its muzzle from the water, but watched the craft's passage with pensive yellow-green eyes. Cain remembered the brave tiger he had been forced to kill in India a short time before, and turned away. Cain was full of impatience, irritation, and a gathering premonition of danger. He had slept poorly due to the heat. His mind continually flashed with visions of the snow-capped mountains of Montana. Even the barren ice fields of Antarctica seemed attractive. He wasn't certain why he had accepted General Zhou Tzu's hospitality, other than he really had no choice. The men Cain had incapacitated in the trading post apparently did not hold grudges, but neither did they seem anxious to treat him as an equal. He noticed they showed a great deal more deference to Nora Pennock, as if she were more than Zhou Tzu's guest. The warlord had promised they would arrive in the vicinity of Angkor Thom by noon, and it was there he hoped to find Brewster Filboid, and maybe a clue to Brigid's whereabouts. He tried not to worry about her, but that was impossible. He cursed quietly, damning the gestalt of their relationship that had them depending on each other one minute, then at each other's throat the next. The memory of the kiss he'd given her when they'd taken the jump back in time to the eve of the Nupcost ghosted across his mind. It was no surprise that he remembered the kiss, but the intensity of the emotions associated with that memory disturbed him. At the sound of a footfall on the deck planks behind him, Cain whirled, teeth bared, wrist tendons tightening, hand opening to receive the sin-eater no longer fastened to his forearm. Nora looked at him, wide-eyed, startled by his reaction. She was dressed in a flowing skirt slit up one side nearly to her right hip. A black halter top left most of her midriff bare. Her hair, bound by a green scarf, was tucked up under a straw hat. The brim shadowed the distinctly occidental cast of her eyes and features. Her right arm was still crooked in the sling.
My God, Kane, you're as jumpy as the proverbial cat on a hot tin roof.
I know. And for the life of me, I can't imagine why. Can you?
Nora refused to respond to his sarcastic rejoinder. A smile touched her lips, and she gazed up at the sunlight piercing the overhead tangle of branches, liana vines, and leaves. Golden brown monkeys scampered among the high pathways.
Green Mansions.
What?
The title of a very old book I read as a child in England. The heroine, Rima, was a girl raised in the rainforests of Amazonia. I feel a little like her now.
Hmm. I'd say you're more like a hostage.
How can you possibly say that? The general rescued me.
Or captured you. Why is it that Bridget and Brewster just happened to be captured, but you were rescued?
I suppose it's all a matter of perspective, isn't it? I don't feel like a hostage or a prisoner.
What do you feel like?
A recruit in a cause.
A revolution?
Perhaps.
I thought that was your work at Cerberus.
It is your work, Kane. I was only a house guest, an emigre, an expatriate. Here I am helping a dedicated man to restore a modicum of freedom to a subjugated people.
Really? Once again, I thought that was what we were trying to do in Cerberus.
There are many different kinds of revolution, Kane.
As far as I know, every kind of revolution needs the same things, not the least of which are weapons.
I'm not an idiot.
Kane wiped at the perspiration trickling into his eyes.
Frankly, I don't know what you are, sweetheart.
You never did, Kane. I'm just one of many people you evacuated from the moon base. Cerberus isn't my home, but I've learned some important things about it.
Like what?
Like there are more weapons there than can possibly be used by the personnel.
Kane gazed at her, eyes widening, then narrowing to slits. He showed his teeth in a hard, humorless grin.
I think I'm starting to get it now. You told your general about the armory, didn't you?
Yes.